I didn't know where Amy and her sons were. I could only be grateful that they weren't in the house at the moment. I ran into the bedroom, gasping. Jamie was kneeling by the window, methodically loading guns and saying something under his breath in Gaelic. Prayer or cursing, I couldn't tell. I didn't ask if he was hurt. His face was bruised, his lip was split, and blood had run down his chin onto his shirt. He was covered with dirt and what I assumed to be smears of other people's blood, and the ear on the side closest me was swollen. But he was steady in his movements, and anything short of a fractured skull would have to wait. "They mean to kill us," I said, and didn't mean it as a question. He nodded, eyes on his work, then handed me a spare pistol to load.
"Aye, they do. Good job the wains are all safe away, isn't it?"
He smiled at me suddenly, bloody-toothed and fierce, and I felt steadier than I had for a long time. He left one side of the shutter ajar. I moved carefully back behind him and peered out, the loaded pistol primed and in my hand. "No bodies lying in the dooryard," I reported. "I suppose you didn't kill any of them?"
"Not for want of trying," he replied. "God, what I'd give for a rifle."
He rose cautiously to his knees, the barrel of the fowling piece protruding over the sill, and surveyed the state of the attack. They had withdrawn for the moment. A small group was visible under the chestnut trees at the far side of the clearing, and they'd taken the horses down towards Bree and Roger's cabin, safely out of range of flying bullets. Brown and his minions were clearly planning what to do next. "What do you suppose they would have done if I'd agreed to go with them?" I could feel my heart again, at least. It was going a mile a minute, but I could breathe, and some feeling was coming back into my extremities.
"I should never have let you go," he replied shortly.
"And quite possibly Richard Brown knows that," I said. He nodded. He'd been thinking along the same lines. Brown had never intended actually to arrest me, only to provoke an incident in which we could both be killed under circumstances dubious enough as to prevent wholesale retaliation by Jamie's tenants.
"Mrs. Bug got out, did she?" he asked.
"Yes, if they didn't catch her outside the house." I narrowed my eyes against the brilliant afternoon sun, searching for a short, broad figure in skirts among the group by the chestnut trees. But I saw only men. Jamie nodded again, hissing gently through his back teeth as he swiveled the gun barrel slowly through an arc that covered the dooryard.
"We'll see then," was all he said. "Come that wee bit closer, man," he murmured,
as one man started cautiously across the yard toward the house.
"One shot. That's all I ask. Here, Sassenach, take this."
He pushed the fowling piece into my hands and selected his favourite of the pistols, a long-barrelled Highland dag with a scroll butt. The man, it was Richard Brown I saw, stopped some distance away, pulled a handkerchief from the waist of his breeches, and waved it slowly overhead. Jamie snorted briefly, but let him come on.
"Fraser," he called, coming to a stop at a distance of 40 yards or so. "Fraser, do you hear me?"
Jamie sighted carefully and fired. The ball struck the ground a few feet in front of Brown, raising a sudden puff of dust from the path, and Brown leapt in the air as though stung by a bee.
"What's the matter with you?" he yelled indignantly. "Have you never heard of a flag of truce, you horse-stealing scotcher?" "If I wanted you dead, Brune, you'd be cooling this minute," Jamie shouted back. "Speak your piece."
What he did want was plain. He wanted them wary of coming closer to the house. It was impossible to hit anything accurately with a pistol at 40 yards, and not that easy with a musket.
"You know what I want," Brown called.
He took off his hat, wiping sweat and dirt from his face.
"I want that goddamn murderous witch of yours."
The answer to that was another carefully aimed pistol ball. Brown jumped again, but not so high.
"Look, you," he tried again, with a conciliating note in his voice. "We ain't going to hurt her. We mean to take her to Hillsborough for trial. A fair trial. That's all."
Jamie handed me the second pistol to reload, took another, and fired.
"He had to give Brown credit for persistence," I thought.
Of course, it had probably dawned on him that Jamie either couldn't or wouldn't actually hit him, and he doggedly stood his ground through two more shots, yelling that they meant to take me to Hillsborough, and surely to God, if I were innocent, Jamie would want a trial, shouldn't he? It was hot upstairs, and sweat was trickling down between my breasts. I blotted the fabric of my shift against my chest. With no answer save the whine of pistol balls, Brown threw up his hands in exaggerated pantomime of a reasonable man tried beyond endurance, and stamped back to his men beneath the chestnut trees. Nothing had changed, but seeing the narrow back of him made me breathe a little easier. Jamie was still crouched in the window, pistol at the ready, but seeing Brown go back, he relaxed and sat back on his heels, sighing.
"Is there water, Sassenach?"
"Yes." The bedroom ewer was full. I poured him a cup, and he drank it thirstily. We had food, water, and a fair amount of shot and powder. I didn't, however, foresee a long siege ahead. "What do you suppose they'll do?" I didn't go near the window, but by standing to one side, I could see them clearly, gathered in conference under the trees. The air was still and heavy, and the leaves above them hung like damp rags. Jamie came to stand behind me, dabbing at his lip with the tail of his shirt.
"Fire the house as soon as it's dark, I suppose,"
he said, matter-of-factly.
"I would. Though I suppose they might try dragging Gideon out and threatening to put a ball through his head, and I didn't give ye up."
He seemed to think this last was a joke, but I failed to see the humour in it. He saw my face and put a hand behind my back, drawing me close for a moment. The air was hot and sticky, and we were both wringing wet, but the nearness of him was a comfort, nonetheless.
"So," I said, taking a deep breath, "it all depends on whether Mrs. Bugg got away, and who she's told."
"She'll have gone for Arch first thing."
Jamie patted me gently and sat down on the bed.
"If he's to whom, he'll run for Kenny Lindsay. He's nearest. After that..."
He shrugged and closed his eyes, and I saw that his face was pale under the sunburn and the smears of dirt and blood.
"Jamie, are you hurt?"
He opened his eyes and gave me a small, one-sided smile, trying not to stretch his torn lip.
"No, I've broken my bloody finger again, is all."
He raised a shoulder in deprecation, but let me lift his right hand to look. It was a clean break, that was all that could be said for it. The fourth finger was stiff, the joints fused from being so badly broken long ago in Wentworth Prison. He couldn't bend it, and it therefore stuck out awkwardly. This wasn't the first time he'd snapped it. He swallowed as I felt gently for the break, and closed his eyes again, sweating.
"There's laudanum in the surgery," I said. "Or whiskey."
I knew he would refuse, though, and he did.
"I'll want a clear head," he said, "whatever happens."
He opened his eyes and gave me the ghost of a smile. The room was sweltering and airless, despite the open shutter. The sun was more than halfway down the sky, and the first shadows were gathering in the corners of the room. I went down to the surgery to fetch a splint and bandage. It wouldn't help a lot, but it was something to do. The surgery was dark with the shutters closed, but with the windows broken, air came through them, making the room seem oddly exposed and vulnerable. I walked in like a mouse, quiet, stopping abruptly, listening for danger, whiskers twitching. Everything was quiet, though.
"Too quiet," I said aloud, and laughed. Moving with purpose and ignoring the noise, I set my feet down firmly and opened cupboard doors with abandon, banging instruments and rattling bottles as I looked out what I needed. I stopped into the kitchen before returning upstairs, partly to reassure myself that the back door was firmly bolted, and partly to see what bits of food Mrs. Bug might have left out. He hadn't said so, but I knew the pain of the broken finger was making Jamie mildly nauseated. And in him, food generally quelled that sort of disturbance and made him feel more settled. The cauldron was still over the coals, but the fire, untended, had burned down so far that the soup had luckily not boiled away. I poked up the embers and put on 3 sticks of fat pine, as much by way of thumbing my nose at the besiegers outside as from the long ingrained habit of never letting a fire die. "Let them see the spray of sparks from the chimney," I thought, "and imagine us sitting peacefully down to eat by our hearth. Or better yet, imagine us sitting by the blazing fire, melting lead and moulding bullets." In this defiant frame of mind, I went back upstairs, equipped with medical supplies, an alfresco lunch, and a large bottle of black ale. I couldn't help but notice, though, the echo of my footsteps on the stair, and the silence that settled quickly back into place behind me, like water when one steps out of it. I heard a shot just as I approached the head of the stair, and took the last step so fast that I tripped and would have fallen headlong, save for reeling into the wall. Jamie appeared from Mr. Weems's room, fowling piece in hand, looking startled. "Are you all right, Sassenach?" "Yes," I said crossly, wiping spilled soup off my hand with my apron. "What in the name of God are you shooting at?"
"Nothing. I only wanted to make the point that the back of the house is nae safer than the front, if they thought of creeping up that way. Just to ensure that they do wait for dark to fall."
I bound up his finger, which seemed to help a little. The food, as I'd hoped, helped considerably more. He ate like a wolf, and rather to my surprise, so did I.
"The condemned ate a hearty meal," I observed, picking up crumbs of bread and cheese. "I'd always thought being in danger of death would make one too nervous to eat, but apparently not."
He shook his head, took a swallow of ale, and passed me the bottle.
"A friend once told me, the body has nae conscience. I dinna ken that that's entirely so, but it is true that the body doesna generally admit the possibility of non-existence. And if ye exist, well, ye need food, that's all."
He grinned one-sided at me, and tearing the last of the sweet rolls in half, gave one to me. I took it, but didn't eat it immediately. There was no sound outside, save the buzzing of cicadas, though the air had a sultry thickness to it that often presaged rain. It was early in the summer for storms, but one could only hope.
"You thought of it too, haven't you?" I said quietly.
He made no pretense of misunderstanding me.
"Well, it is the 21st of the month," he said.
"It's June, for heaven's sake! And the wrong year as well. That newspaper clipping said January of 1776. I was absurdly indignant, as though I had somehow been cheated. He found that funny.
"I was a printer myself, Sassenach," he said, laughing through a mouthful of sweet roll. "You dinna want to believe everything you read in the newspapers, aye?"
When I looked out again, only a few men were visible under the chestnut trees. One of them saw my movement. He waved his arm slowly to and fro above his head, then drew the edge of his hand flat across his throat. The sun was just above the treetops, 2 hours perhaps to nightfall. 2 hours surely was enough time for Mrs. Bug to have summoned help, though, always assuming she had found anyone who would come. Arch might have gone to Cross Creek. He went once a month. Kenny might be hunting. As for the newer tenants, without Roger to keep them in order, their suspicion and dislike of me had become blatant. I had the feeling that they might come if summoned, but only to cheer as I was dragged away. If anyone did come, what then? I didn't want to be dragged away.
much less shot or burned alive in the ashes of my house. But I didn't want anyone else injured or killed in the effort to prevent it, either.
"Come away from the window, Sassenach," Jamie said.
He held out a hand to me, and I went, sitting on the bed beside him. I felt all at once exhausted, the adrenaline of emergency having burned away, leaving my muscles feeling like heat-softened rubber.
"Lie down, Ahocha," he said softly. "Lay your head in my lap."
Hot as it was, I did so, finding it a comfort to stretch out. Even more to hear his heart thumping slow and solid above my ear, and feel his hand light on my head.
All the weapons were laid out, ranged on the floor beside the window, all loaded, primed, and ready for use.
He'd taken his sword down from the armoire. It stood by the door, a last resort.
"There's nothing we can do now, is there?" I said, after a little. "Nothing but wait."
His fingers moved idly through the damp curls of my hair. It fell to just above my shoulders now, long enough, barely, to tie back or pin up.
"Well, we might say an act of contrition," he said. "We did that, always, the night before a battle. Just in case," he added, smiling down at me.
"All right," I said, after a pause. "Just in case." I reached up, and his good hand closed round mine.
"Mon Dieu, je regrette," he began.
And I remembered that he said this prayer in French, harking back to those days as a mercenary in France. How often had he said it then, a necessary precaution, cleansing the soul at night in expectation of the possibility of death in the morning? I said it too, in English, and we fell silent. The cicadas had stopped. Far, far away, I thought I heard a sound that might be thunder. "Do you know," I said, after a long while, "I'm sorry for a great many things and people. Rupert, Murta, Dougal, Frank, Malva," I added softly with a catch in my throat. "But speaking only for myself," I cleared my throat. "I don't regret anything," I said, watching the shadows creep in from the corners of the room. "Not one bloody thing."
"Nor do I, Munion Down," he said,
and his fingers stilled, warm against my skin.
"Nor do I."
I woke from a doze with a smell of smoke in my nostrils. Being in a state of grace is all very well, but I imagine even Joan of Arc had qualms when they lit the first brand. I sat bolt upright, heart pounding, to see Jamie at the window. It wasn't quite dark yet. Streaks of orange and gold and rose lit the sky to the west and touched his face with a fiery light. He looked long-nosed and fierce, the lines of strain cut deep.
"Folk are coming," he said.
His voice was matter-of-fact, but his good hand was clenched hard round the edge of the shutter, as though he would have liked to slam and bolt it. I came to stand by him, combing my fingers hastily through my hair. I could still make out figures under the chestnut trees, though they now were no more than silhouettes. They'd built a bonfire there, at the far edge of the dooryard. That's what I'd smelled. There were more people coming into the dooryard, though. I was sure I had made out the squat figure of Mrs. Bug among them. The sound of voices floated up, but they weren't talking loudly enough to make out words.
"Will you plait my hair, Sassenach? I cannae manage with this."
He gave his broken finger a cursory glance. I lit a candle, and he moved a stool to the window so he could keep watch while I combed his hair and braided it into a tight, thick queue, which I clubbed at the base of his neck and tied with a neat black ribbon. I knew his reasons were twofold, not only to appear well-groomed and gentlemanly, but to be ready to fight if he had to.
I was less worried about someone seizing me by the hair, as I attempted to cleave them in half with a sword, but supposed that if this were my last appearance as the Lady of the Ridge, I shouldn't appear unkempt. I heard him mutter something under his breath as I brushed my own hair by candlelight, and turned on my stool to look at him.
"Hiram's come," he informed me. "I hear his voice. That's good."
"If you say so," I said dubiously, recollecting Hiram Crombie's denunciations in church a week before, thinly veiled remarks clearly aimed at us. Roger hadn't mentioned them, Amy McCullum had told me. Jamie turned his head to look at me and smiled, an expression of extraordinary sweetness coming over his face.
"You're very lovely, Sassenach," he said, as though surprised. "But aye, it's good. Whatever he thinks, he wouldna countenance Brown hanging us in the dooryard, nor yet setting the house afire to drive us out."
There were more voices outside. The crowd was growing quickly.
"Mr. Fraser!"
He took a deep breath, took the candle from the table, and threw open the shutter, holding the candle near his face so they could see him. It was almost full dark, but several of the crowd were holding torches, which gave me uneasy visions of a mob coming to burn Dr. Frankenstein's monster, but did at least allow me to make out the faces below. There were at least 30 men, and not a few women there, in addition to Brown and his thugs. Hiram Crombie was indeed there, standing beside Richard Brown, and looking like something out of the Old Testament.
"We require you to come down, Mr. Fraser," he called, "and your wife, if you please."
I caught sight of Mrs. Bugg, plump and clearly terrified, her face streaked with tears. Then Jamie closed the shutters gently and offered me his arm. Jamie had worn both dirk and sword and hadn't changed his clothes. He stood on the porch, blood-stained and battered, and dared them to harm us further.
"You'll take my wife over my dead body," he said, raising his powerful voice enough to be heard across the clearing.
I was rather afraid they would. He'd been right, so far, about Hiram not countenancing lynching, but it was clear that public opinion was not in our favour.
"Thou shalt not suffer our witch to live!" someone shouted from the back of a crowd, and a stone whistled through the air, bouncing off the front of the house with a sharp report like a gunshot. It struck no more than a foot from my head, and I flinched, instantly regretting it.
Angry murmurs had arisen from the moment Jamie had opened the door, and this encouraged them. There were shouts of "murderers!" and "heartless, heartless!" and a number of Gaelic insults that I didn't try to understand.
"If she didn't do it, Bregara, who did?" someone bellowed.
"Liar," it meant. The man Jamie had slashed across the face with his dirk was in the forefront of the crowd. The open wound gaped, still oozing, and his face was a mask of dried blood.
"If it wasn't her, 'twas him," he shouted, pointing at Jamie. "Fia shur, sacha, lecher, lecher!"
There was an ugly rumble of agreement at that, and I saw Jamie shift his weight and set his hand to his sword, ready to draw if they charged him.
"Be still!"
Hiram's voice was rather shrill but penetrating.
"Be still, I tell you!"
He pushed Brown aside and came up the steps very deliberately. At the top, he gave me a look of revulsion, but then turned to the crowd.
"Justice!"
one of Brown's men yelled before he could speak.
"We want justice!"
"Aye, we do," Hiram shouted back.
"And justice we shall have for the poor reaped lass and her bairn unborn."
A satisfied growl greeted this, and icy terror ran down my legs so that I feared my knees would give way.
"Justice, justice!"
Various people were taking up the chant, but Hiram stopped them, raising both hands as though he were Bloody Moses parting the Red Sea.
"Justice is mine, saith the Lord," Jamie remarked,
in a voice just loud enough to be generally heard.
Hiram, who had evidently been about to say the same thing, gave him a furious look, but couldn't very well contradict him.
"And justice you'll have, Mr. Fraser,"
Brown said, very loudly. He lifted his face, narrow-eyed and malicious with triumph.
"I wish to take her for trial. Anyone accused is entitled to that, nay? If she is innocent. If you are innocent, how can you refuse?"
"Certainly a point," Hiram observed, very dry. "If your wife be clean of the crime, she's naught to fear."
"How say you, sir?"
"I say that should I surrender her to the hands of this man, she will not live to stand a trial,"
Jamie replied hotly.
"He holds me to blame for the death of his brother, and some of you here will ken well enough the truth of that affair,"
he added, lifting his chin to the crowd. Here and there, heads nodded, but they were few. No more than a dozen of Izzardmuir men had been on the expedition that rescued me. In the wake of gossip following it, many of the new tenants would have known only that I had been abducted, assaulted in some scandalous fashion, and that men had died on my account. The mind of the times being what it was, I was well aware that an obscure sense of blame attached to the victim of any sexual crime, unless the woman died, in which case she became at once a spotless angel.
"He will slaughter her out of hand, for the sake of revenge upon me," Jamie said, raising his voice.
He changed abruptly to Gaelic, pointing at Brown.
"Look at yon man, and see the truth of the matter writ upon his face. He has no more to do with justice than with honour, and he would not recognise honour by the smell of its arse."
That made a few of them laugh, in sheer surprise.
Brown, disconcerted, looked round to see what they were laughing at,
which made more of them laugh. The mood of the assembly was still against us, but they were not yet with Brown, who was, after all, a stranger. Hiram's narrow brow creased in consideration.
"What would ye offer by way of guarantee for the woman's safety?" Hiram asked Brown.
"A dozen hogsheads of beer and 3 dozen prime hides," Brown replied promptly. 4 dozen.
His eagerness gleamed in his eyes, and it was all he could do to keep his voice from shaking with the lust to take me. I had a sudden unpleasant conviction that while my death was his ultimate goal, he didn't intend that it should be a quick one, unless circumstances demanded it.
"It would be worth far more than that to ye, Bregar, to have your revenge upon me with her death,"
Jamie said evenly. Hiram glanced from one to the other, unsure what to do. I looked out into the crowd, keeping my face impassive. In truth, it wasn't difficult to do. I felt completely numb. There were a few friendly faces, glancing anxiously to Jamie to see what to do. Kenny and his brothers, Murdo and Evan, stood in a tight group, hands on their dirks and faces set. I didn't know whether Richard Brown had chosen his timing or merely been lucky. Ian was gone, hunting with his Cherokee friends. Arch was plainly gone as well, or he would be visible. Arch and his axe would be uncommonly handy just now, I thought. Fergus and Massali were gone. They too would have helped to stem the tide. But the most important absence was Rogers. He alone had been keeping the Presbyterians more or less under control since the day of Mulver's accusation, or at least keeping a lid on the simmering pot of gossip and animosity. He might have cowed them now, had he been here. The conversation had devolved from high drama to a 3-way wrangle among Jamie, Brown and Hiram, the former too adamant in their positions, and poor Hiram quite unsuited to the task, trying to adjudicate. Insofar as I had feelings to spare, I felt rather sorry for him.
"Take him!"
a voice called suddenly. Alan Christie pushed his way to the front of the crowd and pointed at Jamie. His voice trembled and broke with emotion.
"It's him debauched my sister, him that killed her. If you'll put someone to the trial, take him."
There was a subterranean rumble of agreement at that, and I saw John McNeil and young Hugh Abernathy draw close together, glancing uneasily from Jamie to the three Lindsay brothers, and back again.
"Nay, it's her!"
a woman's voice called in contradiction, high and shrill. "One of the fisher's wives. She stabbed a finger at me, face pinched with malevolence. A man might kill a lass he'd got wee child, but no man would do such a wickedness as to steal a babe unborn frae their womb. No, but a witch would do that. And she found with a poor wee corpse in her hands." A higher susurrus of condemnation greeted that. The men might possibly give me the benefit of doubt. No woman would. By the name of the Almighty! Hiram was losing his grip on the situation and becoming panicky. The situation was perilously close to degenerating into riot. Anyone could feel the currents of hysteria and violence in the air. He cast his eyes up to heaven, looking for inspiration, and found some. "Take them both," he said suddenly. He looked at Brown, then Jamie. "Take them both," he repeated, testing the notion and finding it good. "You'll go along to see that nae harm comes to your wife," he said reasonably to Jamie. "And if it should be proved that she is innocent..." His voice died away on that, as it dawned on him that what he was saying was, if I were proven innocent, Jamie must be guilty, and what a good idea it would be to have him on the spot to be hanged instead. "She is innocent. So am I." Jamie spoke without heat, doggedly repeating it. He had no real hope of convincing anyone. The only doubt among the crowd was whether he or I was the guilty party, or whether we had plotted together to destroy Mulva Christie. He turned suddenly to face the crowd, and cried out to them in Gaelic, "If you will deliver us into the stranger's hand, then our blood be upon your heads, and you will answer for our lives upon the day of judgment." A sudden hush fell on the crowd at that. Men glanced uncertainly at their neighbours, measured Brown and his cohort with doubtful eyes. They were known to the community, but strangers, Sassenachs, in the Scottish sense. So was I, and a witch to boot. Lecher, rapist, and papist murderer he might be, but Jamie, at least, wasn't a stranger. The man I had shot was grinning at me evilly over Brown's shoulder. Evidently I had no more than grazed him, worse luck. I gave him stare for stare, sweat gathering between my breasts, moisture slick and hot beneath the veil of my hair. A murmur was rising among the crowd, argument and disputation, and I could see the Ard's Muir men begin to make their way slowly toward the porch, pushing through the mob. Kenny Lindsay's eyes were fixed on Jamie's face, and I felt Jamie take a deep breath beside me. They would fight for him, if he called them. But there were too few of them, and poorly armed by contrast with Brown's mob. They wouldn't win, and there were women and children in the crowd. To call his men would provoke only bloody riot, and leave the deaths of innocents upon his conscience. That wasn't a burden he could bear. Not now. I saw him come to this conclusion, and his mouth tighten. I had no idea what he might be about to do, but he was forestalled. There was a disturbance at the edge of the crowd. People turned to look, then froze, stricken silent. Thomas Christie came through the crowd. In spite of the darkness and wavering torchlight, I knew at once it was him. He walked like an old man, hunched and halting, looking at no one. The crowd gave way before him at once, deeply respectful of his grief. The grief was plainly marked on his face. He had let his beard and hair go untrimmed, uncombed, and both were matted. His eyes were pouched and bloodshot, the lines from nose to mouth black furrows through his beard. His eyes were alive, though, alert and intelligent. He walked through the crowd, past his son as though he were alone, and came up the steps onto the porch. "I will go with them to Hillsborough," he said quietly to Hiram Crombie. "Let them both be taken, if you will,
but I will travel with them, as surety that no further evil may be done. Surely, justice is mine, if it be anyone's. Brown looked much taken aback by this declaration. Plainly it wasn't what he'd had in mind at all. But the crowd was in instant sympathy, murmuring agreement at the proposed solution. Everyone had the greatest compassion and respect for Tom Christie in the wake of his daughter's murder, and the general feeling seemed to be that this gesture was one of the greatest magnanimity. It was, too, as he had, in all likelihood, just saved our lives, at least for the moment. From the look in his eye, Jamie would strongly have preferred simply to take his chances on killing Richard Brown, but realised that beggars couldn't be choosers, and acquiesced as gracefully as possible with a nod of the head. Christie's gaze rested on me for a moment, then turned to Jamie.
"If it will suit your convenience, Mr. Fraser, perhaps we will leave in the morning. There is no reason why you and your wife should not rest in your own beds."
Jamie bowed to him.
"I thank you, sir," he said, with great formality.
Christie nodded back, then turned and went back down the steps, completely ignoring Richard Brown, who was looking at once irritated and confounded. I saw Kenny Lindsay close his eyes, shoulders slumping in relief. Then Jamie put his hand under my elbow, and we turned, going into our house for what might be the final night spent under its roof.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
A Breath of Snow and Ashes by Diana Gabaldon.
Chapter 88. In the Wake of Scandal. The rain that had threatened arrived in the night, and the day dawned grey, bleak, and wet. Mrs. Bugg was in a similar state, sniffling into her apron and repeating over and over, "Oh, if only Arch had been here! But I couldn't have found anyone save Kenny Lindsay, and by the time he'd run for McNeil and Abernathy."
"Dinna fash yourself for it, Aliannon," Jamie said,
and kissed her affectionately on the brow.
"It may be for the best. No one was damaged. The house is still standing."
He cast a wistful eye towards the rafters, every beam shaped by his own hand.
"And it may be we'll have this wretched matter settled soon, God willing."
"God willing," she echoed fervently, crossing herself. She sniffed and wiped her eyes. "And I've packed a wee bit of food that you shouldn't starve on the way, sir." Richard Brown and his men had sheltered under the trees as best they could. No one had offered them hospitality, which was as damning an indication of their unpopularity as could be imagined, Highland standards being what they were in such matters. And as clear an indication of our own unpopularity, that Brown should be permitted to take us into custody. In consequence, Brown's men were soaking wet, ill-fed, sleepless, and short-tempered. I hadn't slept either, but I was at least full of breakfast, warm and, for the moment, dry, which made me feel a little better, though my heart felt hollow and my bones filled with lead as we reached the head of the trail, and I looked back across the clearing at the house, with Mrs. Bugg standing waving on the porch. I waved back, and then my horse plunged into the darkness of the dripping trees. It was a grim journey, and silent for the most part. Jamie and I rode close together, but couldn't speak of anything important in hearing of Brown's men. As for Richard Brown, he was seriously out of countenance. It was reasonably clear that he had never intended to take me anywhere for trial, but had merely seized upon the pretext as a means of revenging himself on Jamie for Lionel's death. And God knew what he would have done, I reflected, had he known what had really happened to his brother, and Mrs. Bugg there, within arm's length of him. With Tom Christie along, though,
There was nothing he could do. He was obliged to take us to Hillsborough, and he did so with bad grace. Tom Christie rode like a man in a dream. A bad dream. His face closed and inward-looking, speaking to no one. The man Jamie had slashed wasn't there. I supposed he had gone home to Brownsville. The gentleman I had shot was still with us, though. I couldn't tell how bad the wound was, nor yet whether the bullet had gone into him or merely grazed his side. He wasn't incapacitated, but it was plain from the way he hunched to one side, his face contorting now and then, that he was in pain. I hesitated for some time. I had brought a small medical kit with me, as well as saddlebags and bedroll. Under the circumstances, I felt relatively little sense of compassion for the man. On the other hand, instinct was strong, and, as I said to Jamie in an undertone when we stopped to make camp for the evening, it wouldn't help matters if he died of infection. I steeled myself to offer to examine and dress the wound as soon as the opportunity should occur. The man, his name seemed to be Ezra, though under the circumstances no formal introductions had been made, was in charge of distributing bowls of food at supper, and I waited under the pine where Jamie and I had taken shelter, intending to speak kindly to him when he brought our food. He came over, a bowl in each hand, shoulders hunched under a leather coat against the rain. Before I could speak, though, he grinned nastily, spat thickly in one bowl, and handed it to me. The other he dropped at Jamie's feet, spattering his legs with dried venison stew. "Oops," he said mildly, and turned on his heel. Jamie contracted sharply like a big snake coiling, but I got hold of his arm before he could strike. "Never mind," I said, and, raising my voice just a little, said, "Let him rot." The man's head snapped round, wide-eyed. "Let him rot," I repeated, staring at him. I'd seen the flush of fever in his face when he came near, and smelled the faint sweet scent of pus. Ezra looked completely taken aback. He hurried back to the sputtering fire and refused to look in my direction. I was still holding the bowl he'd given me, and was startled to have it taken from my hand. Tom Christie threw the contents of the bowl into a bush and handed me his own, then turned away without speaking. But I started after him, meaning to give it back. We wouldn't starve, thanks to Mrs. Bug's wee bit of food, which filled one entire saddlebag. Jamie's hand on my arm stopped me, though. "Eat it, Sassenach," he said softly. "It's kindly meant." More than kind, I thought. I was aware of hostile eyes upon me from the group around the fire. My throat was tight, and I had no appetite, but I took my spoon from my pocket and ate. Beneath a nearby hemlock tree, Tom Christie had wrapped himself in a blanket and lain down alone, his hat pulled down over his face. It rained all the way to Salisbury. We found shelter in an inn there, and seldom had a fire seemed so welcome. Jamie had brought what cash we had, and in consequence we could afford a room to ourselves. Brown posted a guard on the stair, but that was merely for show. After all, where would we go? I stood in front of the fire in my shift, my wet cloak and gown spread over a bench to dry. "You know," I observed, "Richard Brown hasn't thought this out at all." Not surprising, that, since he hadn't actually intended to take me or us to trial. "Who exactly does he mean to hand us over to?" "The sheriff of the county," Jamie replied, untying his hair and shaking it out over the hearth so that droplets of water sizzled and popped in the fire. "Or failing that, a justice of the peace, perhaps." "Yes, but what then? He's got no evidence, no witnesses. How can there be any semblance of a trial?" Jamie looked at me curiously. "You've never been tried for anything, have you, Sassenach?"
"You know I haven't."
He nodded.
"I have. For treason."
"Yes? And what happened?" He ran a hand through his damp hair, considering.
They made me stand up and asked my name. I gave it. The judge muttered to his friend for a bit. And then he said, "Condemned. Imprisonment for life. Put him in irons."
And they took me out to the courtyard and had a blacksmith hammer fetters onto my wrists. The next day we began walking to Ardsmuir.
They made you walk there? From Inverness?
I wasn't in any great hurry, Sassenach.
I took a deep breath, trying to stem the sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach.
I see. Well, but surely, wouldn't murder, I could just about say it without stammering, but not quite yet, be a matter for a jury trial?
It might, and certainly I shall insist upon it, if things go so far.
Mr. Brown seems to think they may. He's telling everyone in the tap room the story, making us out to be monsters of depravity.
Which, I must say, is no great feat, he added ruefully, considering the circumstances.
I pressed my lips tight together, to avoid giving a hasty answer. I knew, he knew, that I had had no choice. He knew that I knew he had had nothing to do with Mulver in the first place. But I couldn't help but feel a sense of blame in both directions for this desperate muddle in which we found ourselves, both for what had happened afterward and for Mulver's death itself, though God knew I would give anything to have her alive again. He was right about Brown, I realized. Cold and wet, I'd paid little attention to the noises from the tap room below, but I could hear Brown's voice echoing up the chimney, and from the random words that came through, it was apparent that he was doing exactly what Jamie said, blackening our characters, making it out that he and his committee of safety had undertaken the ignoble but necessary job of apprehending us and committing us to justice. And just incidentally, carefully prejudicing any potential jury members by making sure the story spread abroad in all its scandalous detail. "Is there anything to be done?" I asked, having listened to as much of this nonsense as I could stomach. He nodded and pulled a clean shirt from his saddlebag.
"Go down for supper and look as little like depraved murderers as possible, Nanean."
"Right," I said, and with a sigh withdrew the ribbon-trimmed cap I had packed. I shouldn't have been surprised. I had lived long enough to have a fairly cynical view of human nature, and lived long enough in this time to know how directly public opinion expressed itself. And yet, I was still shocked when the first stone hit me in the thigh. We were some distance south of Hillsborough. The weather continued wet, the roads muddy, and the travel difficult. I think Richard Brown would have been pleased to relinquish us to the Sheriff of Rowan County, if such a person had been available. The office, he was informed, was currently unfilled, the last occupant having decamped hurriedly overnight, and no one yet found willing to replace him. A matter of politics, I gathered, the recent sheriff having leaned toward independency, whilst the majority of persons in the county were still strongly loyalist. I didn't learn the specifics of the incident that had triggered the recent sheriff's hasty departure, but the taverns and inns near Hillsborough were buzzing like hornets' nests in the wake of it. The circuit court had ceased to meet some months before, Brown was informed, the justices who attended it feeling it too dangerous to appear in the present unsettled state of things. The sole justice of the peace, he was able to discover, felt similarly, and declined point blank to take custody of us, informing Brown that it was more than his life was worth to be involved in anything even faintly controversial at the moment.
"But it's nothing to do with politics," Brown had shouted at him, frustrated. "It's murder, for God's sake. Black murder."
"Anything and everything's political these days, sir,"
the J.P., one Harvey Micklegrass, informed him sadly, shaking his head.
"I should not venture to address even a case of drunken disorderly for fear of having my house pulled down round my ears and my wife left widowed." The sheriff attempted to sell his office but could find no one willing to purchase it. "No, sir, you'll have to go elsewhere."
Brown would by no means take us to Cross Creek or Campbellton, where Jocasta Cameron's influence was strong, and where the local justice was her good friend Farquhar Campbell. And so we headed south, toward Wilmington. Brown's men were disedified. They had expected a simple lynching and a house-burning, perhaps the odd bit of looting. Not this long, drawn-out and tedious plodding from place to place. Their spirits were further lowered when Ezra, who had been clinging to his horse in a dogged daze of fever, fell suddenly into the road and was picked up, dead. I didn't ask to examine the body, and wouldn't have been given leave in any case. But I rather thought from the lolling looks of him that he had simply lost consciousness, tumbled off, and broken his neck. Not a few of the others cast looks of open fear toward me in the wake of this occurrence, though, and their sense of enthusiasm for the venture diminished visibly. Richard Brown was not deterred. He would, I was sure, have shot us without mercy long since, had it not been for Tom Christie, silent and grey as the morning fog on the roads. He said little, and that little confined to necessities. I should have thought him moving mechanically in the numb haze of grief, had I not turned one evening as we camped by the road, to see his eyes fixed upon me, with a look of such naked anguish in them, that I glanced hastily away, only to see Jamie sitting beside me, watching Tom Christie with a very thoughtful expression. For the most part, though, he kept his face impassive, what could be seen of it, under the shade of his leather slouch hat. And Richard Brown, prevented by Christie's presence from doing us active harm, took every opportunity to spread his version of the tale of Mulver's murder, perhaps as much to harrow Tom Christie in the hearing of it over and over again, as for its effect on our reputations. At any rate, I shouldn't have been surprised when they stoned us in a small nameless hamlet south of Hillsborough. But I was. A young boy had seen us on the road, stared as we rode by, then vanished like a fox scampering down a bank with the news. And 10 minutes later, we rode around a bend in the road and into a fusillade of stones and shrieks. One struck my mare on the shoulder and she shied violently. I kept my seat narrowly, but was off balance. Another hit me in the thigh, and another high in the chest, knocking the breath from me. And when one more bounced painfully off my head, I lost my grip on the reins, and as the horse panicked, curvetted and spun, I flew off, landing on the ground with a bone-shaking thud. I should have been terrified. In fact, I was furious. The stone that had hit me in the head had glanced off, thanks to the thickness of my hair and the cap I wore, but with the infuriating sting of a slap or a pinch rather than true impact. I was on my feet by reflex, staggering, but caught sight of a jeering boy on the bank above me, hooting and dancing in triumph. I lunged, caught him by the foot and jerked. He yelped, slipped, and fell on top of me. We crashed to the ground together and rolled in a tangle of skirts and cloak. I was older, heavier, and completely berserk. All the fear, misery, and uncertainty of the last weeks came to an instant boil, and I punched his sneering face twice, as hard as I could. I felt something crack in my hand, and pain shot up my arm. He bellowed and wriggled to escape. He was smaller than I was, but strong with panic. I struggled to keep a grip on him, got him by the hair. He struck out at me, flailing, and knocked off my cap, getting one hand in my hair and yanking hard. The pain reignited my fury, and I jammed the knee into him anywhere I could, again and once more, blindly seeking his soft parts. His mouth opened in a soundless "Oh!" and his eyes bulged. His fingers relaxed and let go of my hair, and I reared up over him and slapped him as hard as I possibly could. A big rock struck my shoulder with a numbing blow, and I was knocked sideways by the impact. I tried to hit him again, but couldn't lift my arm. Panting and sobbing, he writhed free of my cloak and scrambled away on hands and knees, nose bleeding. I whirled on my knees to look after him, and looked straight into the eyes of a young man, his face intent and blazing with excitement, rock at the ready. It hit me in the cheekbone, and I swayed, my vision gone blurry.
Then something very large hit me from behind, and I found myself flat on my face, pressed into the ground, the weight of a body on top of mine. It was Jamie. I could tell by the breathless, "Holy Mother!" His body jerked as the stones hit him. I could hear the horrifying thud of them into his flesh. There was a lot of shouting going on. I heard Tom Christie's hoarse voice, then the firing of a single shot. More yelling, but of a different character. One or two soft thumps, stones striking earth nearby. A last grunt from Jamie as one slammed into him. We lay pressed flat for a few moments, and I became aware of the uncomfortably spiky plant squashed under my cheek, the scent of its leaves harsh and bitter in my nose. Then Jamie sat up, slowly, drawing in his breath with a catch, and I rose in turn on a shaky arm, nearly falling. My cheek was puffed, and my hand and shoulder throbbed, but I had no attention to spare for that. "Are you all right?" Jamie had got halfway to his feet, then sat down again suddenly. He was pale, and a trickle of blood ran down the side of his face from a cut in his scalp. But he nodded, a hand pressed to his side.
"Aye, fine," he said,
but with a breathlessness that told me he likely had cracked ribs.
"You're all right, Sassenach?"
"Fine." I managed to get to my feet, trembling. Brown's men were scattered, some chasing the horses who had fled in the melee, others cursing, gathering up scattered bits of belongings from the road. Tom Christie was vomiting into the bushes by the road. Richard Brown stood under a tree, watching, his face white. He glanced at me sharply, then away. We stopped at no more taverns on the way. Chapter 89. A Moonlicht Pflicht.
"When you go to hit someone, Sassenach, you want to do it in the soft parts. Faces have too many bones. And then there's the teeth to be thinking of."
Jamie spread her fingers, gently pressing the scraped, swollen knuckles, and air hissed between her own teeth. "Thanks so much for the advice. And you've broken your hand how many times hitting people?" He wanted to laugh. The vision of her pounding that wee boy in a fury of berserk rage, hair flying in the wind and a look of blood in her eye, was one he would treasure. He didn't, though.
"Your hand's not broken, Anion."
He curled her fingers, cupping her loose fist with both of his. "How would you know?" she snapped. "I'm the doctor here." He stopped trying to hide his smile.
"If it were broken," he said, "you'd be white and puking, not red-faced and crank it."
"Crank it, my arse!" She pulled her hand free, glaring at him as she nursed it against her bosom. She was, in fact, only slightly flushed, and most attractive, with her hair curling out in a wild mass round her head. One of Brown's men had picked up her fallen cap after the attack, timidly offering it to her. Enraged, she had snatched it from him and stuffed it violently into a saddlebag.
"Are you hungry, lass?"
"Yes," she admitted grudgingly, as aware as he was that folk with broken bones generally had little appetite immediately, though they ate amazingly once the pain had backed a bit. He rummaged in the saddlebag, blessing Mrs. Bug as he came out with a handful of dried apricots and a large wrapped wedge of goat's cheese. Brown's men were cooking something over their fire, but he and Claire hadn't touched any food but their own, not since the first night.
"How much longer might this farce go on?"
he wondered, breaking off a bit of cheese and handing it to his wife. They had food for perhaps a week, with care. Long enough, maybe, to reach the coast, and the weather held good.
"And what then?"
It had been plain to him from the first that Brown had no plan, and was attempting to deal with a situation that had been out of his control since the first moment. Brown had ambition, greed, and a respectable sense of revenge, but almost no capacity of forethought. That much was clear. Now here he was, saddled with the two of them, forced to travel on and on, the unwelcome responsibility dragging like a worn-out shoe tied to a dog's tail.
and Brown, the hindered dog, snarling and turning in circles, snapping at the thing that hampered him, and biting his own tail in consequence. Half his men had been wounded by the flung stones. Jamie thoughtfully touched a large, painful bruise on the point of his elbow. He himself had had no choice. Now Brown hadn't either. His men were growing restive. They had crops to tend, and hadn't bargained for what they must see now as a fool's errand. It would be a simple matter to escape by himself. But then what? He wouldn't leave Claire in Brown's hands, and even were he able to get her safe away, they couldn't return to the ridge with matters as they were. To do so would be to find themselves straight back in the pot. He sighed, then caught his breath, and let it out gingerly. He didn't think his ribs were cracked, but they hurt.
"You've a bit of ointment, I expect," he said, nodding at the bag that held her bits of medicine.
"Yes, of course." She swallowed her bite of cheese, reaching for the bag. "I'll put some on that cut on your head." He let her do that, but then insisted upon anointing her hand in turn. She objected, insisting that she was perfectly fine, needed no such thing. They should save the ointment in case of future need. And yet she let him take her hand and smooth the sweet-smelling cream into her knuckles, the small, fine bones of her hand hard under his fingers. She so hated being helpless in any way. But the armour of righteous fury was wearing off, and while she kept a fierce face for Brown and the rest, he knew she was afraid. Not without reason, either. Brown was uneasy, unable to settle. He moved to and fro, talking aimlessly with one man or another, needlessly checking the hobbled horses, pouring a cup of chicory coffee and holding it undrunk until it grew cold, then flinging it into the weeds. And all the time his restless gaze returned to them. Brown was hasty, impetuous, and half-baked. He wasn't entirely stupid, Jamie thought. And clearly he had realized that his strategy of spreading gossip and scandal concerning his prisoners in order to endanger them had severe defects, so long as he was himself obliged to continue in close proximity to said prisoners. Their simple meal finished, he lay down carefully, and Claire curled herself into him, spoon-wise, wanting comfort. Fighting was an exhausting business, and so was fear. She was asleep in moments. Jamie felt the pull of sleep, but wouldn't yield to it yet. He occupied himself instead in reciting some of the poems Brianna had told him. He quite liked the one about the silversmith in Boston riding to spread the alarm to Lexington, which he considered a handsome piece. The company was beginning to settle for the night. Brown was still a fidget, sitting staring darkly at the ground, then leaping to his feet to stride up and down. By contrast, Christie had barely stirred, though he made no move to go to bed. He sat on a rock, his supper barely touched. A flicker of movement near Christie's boot. A wee small mouse making feints toward the neglected plate that sat on the ground, filled with bounty. It had occurred to Jamie a couple of days before, in the vague way that one recognizes a fact unconsciously known for some time, that Tom Christie was in love with his wife. "Poor bugger," he thought. Surely Christie didn't believe that Claire had had aught to do with the death of his daughter. If so, he wouldn't be here. Did he think that Jamie, though? He lay in the shelter of the darkness, watching the fire play across Christie's haggard features, his eyes half-hooded, giving no hint of his thoughts. There were men who could be read like books. Tom Christie wasn't one of them. But if ever he had seen a man being eaten alive before his eyes... Was it the fate of his daughter alone, or also the desperate need of a woman? He'd seen that need before, that gnawing at the soul, and knew it personally. Or did Christie think that Claire had killed wee Mulva, or been in some way involved? There would be a quandary for an honourable man.
The need of a woman. The thought of it brought him back to the moment, and the awareness that the sounds he'd been listening for in the woods behind him were now there. He had known for the past 2 days that they were being followed, but last night they had camped in an open meadow, with no cover at all. Moving slowly, but with no attempt at furtiveness, he rose, covered Claire with his cloak, and stepped into the wood, like one called by nature. The moon was pale and hunchbacked, and there was little light beneath the trees. He closed his eyes to damp the fire shadow, and opened them again to the dark world, that place of shapes that lacked dimension and air, that held spirits. It was no spirit that stepped out from behind the blur of a pine tree, though.
"Blessed Michael, defend us," he said softly.
"The blessed host of angels and archangels be with you, Uncle," said Ian in the same soft tone. "Though I'm thinking that a few thrones and dominations wouldn't have come amiss either."
"Well, I wouldn't argue if divine intervention chose to take a hand," Jamie said, heartened most amazingly by his nephew's presence. "I'm sure I've no notion how else we shall escape this foolish coil."
Ian grunted at that. Jamie saw his nephew's head turn, checking the faint glow of the camp. Without discussion, they moved further into the wood.
"I cannot be gone for long without they come after me," he said. "First, then, is all well with the ridge?"
Ian lifted a shoulder.
"There's talk," he said,
the tone of his voice indicating that talk covered everything from old wives' gossip to the sort of insult that must be settled by violence.
"No one killed yet, though. What shall I do, Uncle Jamie?"
"Richard Brown. He's thinking, and God only kens what that will lead to."
"He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous," Ian said, and laughed.
Jamie, who had never known his nephew to read a book willingly, gave him a look of disbelief, but dismissed questions in favour of the pressing concerns of the moment.
"Aye, he is," he said dryly. "He's been spreading the story in pothouses and inns as we go, but I guess in hopes of rousing public indignation to the point that some poor fool of a constable can be pushed into taking us off his hands, or better yet, that a mob might be stirred up to seize us and hang us out of hand, thus resolving his difficulty."
"Oh, aye.
Well, if that's what he had in mind, Uncle, as working, you wouldn't have countenanced some of the things I've heard following in your tracks."
"I know." Jamie stretched gently, easing his painful ribs. It was only the mercy of God that it hadn't been worse. That, and Claire's rage, which had interrupted the attack, as everyone stopped to watch the engrossing spectacle of her hatcheling her assailant like a bundle of flax.
"It's come home to him, though, that if you mean to pin a target on someone, it's wise to step away smartly thereafter. He's thinking, as I say, should he go off then, or send someone?"
"I'll follow, aye, and see what's to do."
He sensed, rather than saw, Ian's nod. They stood in black shadow, the faint haze of moonlight like fog in the space between the trees. The lad moved, as though to go, then hesitated.
"You're sure, Uncle, as it wouldn't be better to wait a bit, then creep away? There's nae bracken, but there's decent cover in the hills nearby. We could be safe hidden by dawn."
It was a great temptation. He felt the pull of the dark wild forest, above all, the lure of freedom, if he could but walk away into the greenwood and stay there. But he shook his head.
"It wouldna do, Ian," he said, though he let regret show in his voice. "We should be fugitives then, and doubtless we have price on our heads. With the countryside already roused against us, broadsides, posted bills, the public would do Brown's work for him promptly. And then to run would seem an admission of guilt forby."
Ian sighed, but nodded agreement.
"Well, then," he said.
He stepped forward and embraced Jamie, squeezing hard for an instant, and then was gone. Jamie let out a long, tentative breath against the pain of his injured ribs.
"God go with you, Ian,"
he said to the dark, and turned back. When he lay down again beside his wife, the camp was silent. The men lay like logs wrapped in their blankets. Two figures, though, remained by the embers of the dying fire. Richard Brown and Thomas Christie, each alone on a rock with his thoughts. Ought he to wake Claire, tell her? He considered for a moment, his cheek against the warm softness of her hair, and reluctantly decided no. It might hearten her a little to know of Ian's presence, but he dare not risk rousing Brown's suspicion. And if Brown were to perceive by any change in Claire's mood or face that something had happened, no, best not. At least, not yet. He glanced along the ground at Christie's feet and saw the faint, pale scurry of movement in the dark. The mouse had brought friends to share her feast.